You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
And Paula Lazon. Hey, this is Commander Tom Garcia. Welcome to American Hour. And, of course, my lovely co-host, Paula Lazon, is with us, broadcasting live from Boston, Massachusetts, where it's much more likely to catch a chest cold versus Palm Beach, Florida, where I live. I'm sitting on the patio where it is, well, my thermometer says 83 degrees. I know it's not that warm.
Oh, my God. You're making me
jealous. It's probably about 78, but I bet if you lived down here, Paula, you would not have got that cold.
No, it's a clear 45 here in the greater Boston area, so no, I probably wouldn't.
Oh, boy. I tell you, Paula, not only am I in South Florida, but the president was here today, and he gave a speech down in Miami.
What did that have to say today? I missed it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I got an audio clip of his presentation today. Yes, I have an audio clip from just 9 seconds worth of his speech today, but it sums it all up, and here we go.
Heaven.
Yes. Obama is a crybaby. It's not my fault. Gas prices going up. Don't blame me. I need 4 more years. It's not my fault. I guarantee you, if gas prices keep going up, the voters will blame him. And in reality, whether it's his fault or not, he's balked on the Keystone Pipeline, on drilling. Now, he made a speech today saying that, oh, drilling's up and production's up and everything's up. I'll tell you what's up. His lies are up. He's lying on a daily basis. Production is up, yes, Paula, but production that is shipping out gasoline to other countries, not staying here. Usage is down. That's one of the things he left out of his speech, that usage is down. And why is that? Crappy economy, but he pats himself on the back and says, usage is down, production's up, blah, 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 all because of a crappy economy. Our oil companies can make more money abroad, and in fact, if they couldn't make more money abroad, they wouldn't be making more money because the usage is down, all because of a crappy economy. It's sort of like the way he claims success in the war on illegal immigration. Illegal immigration is down. But why is it down? Because we've changed our enforcement policies? No, he's suing Arizona for its enforcement policies. He's telling states you can't enforce the law. He's telling the federal government, the FBI, local law enforcement, don't try and deport anybody unless they're a hardened criminal. So deportations are down, but he's claiming victory. And why is that? Because the economy's so bad, illegal immigrants from around the world don't want to come here anymore. That's why it's down. So all of his successes, oil usage down, illegal immigration down, because we have a crappy economy. Wow, what an achievement. Yes, President Obumbler, you have achieved the best of the best. Crappy economy, a near depression, and you have helped us in the areas of illegal immigration and oil usage. Wow. Yeah, but the price of gasoline being up, not my fault. Wow, wow, wow. Crybaby Obama says it's not my fault. Well, there are a lot of things he could have done. And now today he's proposed things that he's going to do to help bring the price of gasoline down and get us off of foreign oil dependence. Remember, Paula, Jimmy Carter commissioned the Department of Energy in 1970 to bring down the price of oil, 1976, to not only get us off of foreign oil dependency, but bring down the price of gasoline. How's that worked so far? It hasn't worked at all. And Obama is proposing the same kind of stuff. Now, we're going to walk through his proposals today. And I got to tell you, it was like listening to nails on a chalkboard. But I just pushed through it, and I listened to his speech. It's difficult, but I did it, Paul. And I don't know, did you see his speech today from Miami?
No, I did not. I know he was on the television yesterday, and I probably caught the last maybe 60 seconds of what he was saying. So,
yeah. It's a good thing. You really don't want to listen to that. Even reading the transcript, I can just hear his voice in the background, and it hurts. You know, I remember all the libtards. Oh, they hated George Bush and his Texas accent. Well, that's racist right there. Oh, you freaking racist. But anyways, they just hated the sound of his voice. Couldn't stand it. Well, good job, libtards. You elected a guy that I can't stand the sound of his voice. And thank goodness he was on a teleprompter today. Otherwise, we would have heard the usual, because without a teleprompter, he can't say a sentence without putting a in there.
Yeah.
So.
Did you have the email that I sent you on President Obama's top 10 constitutional violations from back in December?
Oh, yeah, I got that right on the top of my desktop right now. Now, I realize you got a cold. Now, you said it's a chest cold. I know when you get it's a head cold, the throat can be sore and that kind of stuff. If you want to run through those, be my guest.
Sure.
If you don't feel like talking extra, then I'll run through them. But if you're up for it, I'll let you run through them.
Sure, I'd be happy to muddle my way through it. It's from the Hawaii Reporter. From a December 5th, 2011 article by Ilya Shapiro, one of the biggest political changes that 2011 brought, in large part due to the Tea Parties and their effect on the 2010 election, is the centrality of the Constitution to our public discourse. Lawmakers and citizens no longer consider simply whether a given bill or policy proposal is a good idea, but whether it is constitutional. Where does the government get the power to do that is often critics' rallying cry. The Obama administration and its allies in Congress have perpetrated more than their share of such mob-like actions. While it's hard to narrow them down, here was Ilya's stab at the government's top 10 constitutional violations since President Obama took office. Number one being the individual mandate. No list of President Obama's constitutional violations would be complete without including the requirement that every American purchase health insurance on penalty of civil fine. The individual mandate is unprecedented and exceeds Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. If it is allowed to stand, Congress will be able to impose any kind of economic mandate as part of any kind of national regulatory scheme. Fortunately, the Supreme Court has a chance to strike this down during its current term. What are your thoughts on that, Tom?
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. First of all, the article said that you pay a fine if you don't purchase, you don't engage in commerce. But that's not what the Obama administration is arguing before the Supreme Court. They're arguing it's just a tax. If you recall, and I've got to go get that soundbite, Obama, when he was pushing for Obamacare, said, oh, no, it's not a tax. It's not a tax. Oh, no. Now they're saying, well, yeah, it's a tax because it's unconstitutional to fine people for not engaging in commerce. So
right. It's
a tax. Now, the taxation, that's why they had to go to taxation. Taxation under the Constitution is very, very broad. So it's a tax, except, wait a minute, it's a tax. You engaging in commerce is somehow a tax. Now, that's engaging in commerce. It's not a tax. Taxation would be all Americans will pay 10%, 5%, whatever it is. That's a tax. Telling you you have to go buy something, that's forcing you to engage in interstate commerce, and that's a violation of the Constitution. But they're trying to call it a tax. So this is the problem that they're going to have, and we've talked about on past shows, but the reality here is what precisely is healthcare mandate, individual mandate, forcing you to do. It's forcing you to make decisions about your body. It's forcing you to make private and personal decisions. Now, what does that sound like, Paula? It sounds like Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court ruled that the federal government cannot stop you from having an abortion because it violates your privacy. It also does not give due process. Now, due process is a complicated thing. Due process under the law, oh, I got caught robbing a bank, I have to go to court, and blah, blah, blah. Now, there's another type of due process. When a state or the federal government passes a law, did they give consideration to the impact that would have on every single citizen? So under Obamacare, they have not given due consideration, due process to every single citizen and how it will impact them financially. Does it harm them? There are businesses that are going to go out of business because of Obamacare. So therefore, due process was not given. So the two things that Roe v. Wade was ruled on by the Supreme Court, due process and privacy, are both trumped in Obamacare by commerce, the greater good. We have got to save money. And I mean, that's what they're saying. We've got to save money. Healthcare costs are skyrocketing. They're just out of control. Oh, and I actually found an article the other day, and we'll do it next week, that shows that healthcare costs are not skyrocketing and out of control. But in any case, that's their ruling. So the Supreme Court, if they rule in favor of Obamacare, what they're saying is commerce, in other words, in the name of reducing costs for the greater good, trumps privacy and due process. We've just undone Roe v. Wade, and the Supreme Court will have made themselves irrelevant because every ruling that they could ever come up against in the future will have an impact on interstate commerce, and the Congress now, with simple legislation, can undo that. We don't need a constitutional amendment anymore, if Obamacare stands, to stop abortions and to stop this and to stop that. No. All we need is Congress to pass a law and say, yeah, commerce trumps everything else. Privacy, due process, you name it, commerce trumps it. And who controls commerce in the United States of America? The Congress. There you have it. So that's one reason it cannot possibly stand, because the Supreme Court will ultimately rule themselves irrelevant. And I realize that was a long explanation for his unconstitutional push for Obamacare, but it is truly unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court can't let it stand, or they're done. They can just go home and never come back to work.
Exactly. Number two would be the Medicaid coercion. The court will also be taking up Obamacare's massive intrusion on federal-state relations in the form of a coercive Medicaid expansion. The law compels states to drastically increase their Medicaid expenditures and reorganize their health care bureaucracies on penalty of losing all, not just additional Medicaid funds. No state contemplated such a program when it signed on to Medicaid. Arizona was the last to join in 1982, and now no state can afford to withdraw. Indeed, even if some withdrawal mechanisms existed, withdrawn states' taxpayers would still be funding complying states' Medicaid programs. As the Supreme Court held in South Dakota v. Dole, there comes a point when the financial inducement offered by Congress might be so coercive as to pass the point at which pressure turns into compulsion.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there you go.
Yep. Go ahead. Number three would be the Independent Payment Advisory Board, also known as the Death Panel. IPAB is the group of 15 presidential appointees who, beginning in 2014, are tasked with reducing Medicare spending. Any decisions IPAB makes automatically become law that can only be overridden by a 3/5 majority vote in the Senate. Unlike other federal agencies, IPAB is subject to no external review, no public notification in advance of proposed rules or opportunity for comment, no administrative guidelines, and no judicial review. Medicare comprises about 13% of the federal budget, so that's an awesome amount of power for Congress to delegate to unelected executive branch bureaucrats. It's so basic a violation of traditional separation of powers that there's no historical analog. the Goldwater Institute has filed a strong lawsuit challenging this yet another unprecedented aspect of Obamacare, which will continue wending its way through the lower courts. Maybe she meant winding its way through the lower courts. Regardless of how the Supreme Court rules on the individual mandate and Medicaid coercion issues.
Well, this is a case of this president loves unelected officials controlling us. I mean, this is the Soviet Union all over again. Unelected officials telling the masses what they can and can't do. Absolutely. Independent Payment Advisory Board. Unelected officials. Appointed by the president. It goes back to what our founders tried to avoid. Taxation without representation. This now is control without representation. We have no say in it. We don't know who these people will be. Our congressional representatives. Ultimately, it is taxation without representation, which is unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. And number four would be the Chrysler bailout. Building on the Bush administration's illegal use of TARP funds to bail out the auto industry, the Obama administration bullied Chrysler's secured creditors, who were entitled to absolute priority, into accepting 30 cents on the dollar, while junior creditors such as labor unions received much more. This subversion of creditor rights violates not just bankruptcy law, but also the Constitution's takings and due process clauses. This blatant crony capitalism, government-directed industrial policy to help political insiders, discourages investors and generally undermines confidence in American rule of law.
Well, there you go. There's the due process clause again, and that's precisely what the executive branch did. They rewrote the bankruptcy laws. The bankruptcy laws are written, and they're the law of the land. And the president and his administration cannot change those. But they went in, and you're absolutely right. It was a bullying. I honestly think that investors, the creditors, the senior creditors, should have just said, sorry, the secured creditors, sorry, ain't going to do it. Take us to court. But they were worried. And this guy is a tyrant, is an absolute tyrant. It's an absolute violation of the Constitution and the Due Process Clause.
Mm-hmm. Number five being Dodd-Frank, intended to remedy weaknesses in the U.S. financial system, ensuring transparency and accountability, the Dodd-Frank financial reform empowered unlimited, unreviewable, and often secret bureaucratic discretion. The administrative bodies the legislation created face no constraints on the exercise of arbitrary authority. For example, the Treasury Department now has broad and essentially unchecked power to seize banks and other financial entities that it determines are unsound but too big to fail. The new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and Financial Stability Oversight Council, meanwhile, craft, execute, and interpret their own law. Due process and separation of powers issues abound.
That's exactly right. There's such broad scope in this bill that these councils, you know, like the Protection Bureau and the Financial Stability Oversight Council, they get to interpret like the very broad. For example, like in Obamacare, where it says insurance companies will provide prescription drugs. That's how the president came to the conclusion. Well, you got to provide prescription drugs. The bill doesn't say what prescription drugs. Now we're going to tell you what you have to provide. And, by the way, you have to provide them for free. That is not what's in the bill, but they're going way, way beyond. Now, let me tell you one other thing about Dodd-Frank. It's a supposedly a remedy for the U.S. financial system. Back in 2003 and on, after, you know, a few years after 9/11, we had several airlines. So every single major air carrier went through bankruptcy. When I say major, legacy carrier, that would not include Southwest. Okay, but everybody else went through bankruptcy except American Airlines. We accepted significant concessions as labor groups to avoid bankruptcy. But one of the things we could not get out from under, and I want to make this very, very clear, you've heard it on the Rush Limbaugh show and other shows, the pilots at American Airlines are not the reason for us in bankruptcy now. Our pensions, yes, are part of the reason. But we attempted in 2003 and for the next several years to get financial laws changed so that we could take control of our own pensions. But defined benefit and other pensions, we have two pensions as pilots, two different separate pension plans. We cannot, under existing federal law, take control of those. Now, think about this, Paula. You've got a company that is burdened by plans that many years ago every major corporation gave to their employees, but they just don't work anymore. So we understood that, and we lobbied, and we went to Congress, and we went to the government, and we went to Barney Frank and Chris Dodd and said, let's change the law so that the pilots of American Airlines can take control of their own pensions and thereby relieve the company of this burden. And you know what the answer was? Screw you. Sorry. So when the Dodd-Frank bill was passed, there was the perfect opportunity to stop legacy companies with these kinds of legacy pension plans from having to go through the bankruptcy courts to dissolve these pensions. But no. Sorry. You don't fit our criteria for wanting to help. So the reason, the main reason that American Airlines is in bankruptcy today is because the government said, screw you, go through the bankruptcy courts like everybody else, and that's how you can dissolve the pension plans. So that's why, if you didn't know that out there, everybody, American Airlines is in bankruptcy because of Barney Frank and Chris Dodd saying, screw you, and giving us the middle finger.
Right, exactly. Number six would be the Deepwater drilling ban. Following the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, the Interior Department issued a blanket six-month moratorium on new oil and gas drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. A federal judge struck down that moratorium as arbitrary and capricious, but the government issued a new order to replace the one that was struck down. That order was subsequently withdrawn, but the judge was so shocked by the administration's conduct that he found the government in civil contempt of court. I don't know if many people even know that that occurred.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And then where did a lot of the companies that do deep water drilling go? Well, they went abroad, all around the world, but some of them went to Brazil where, guess what, we loaned Brazil $2 billion to deep water drill. You know, it was all about protecting the environment. Really what the libtards and this administration are telling us is, as long as the water off our coast is okay, damn the rest of the world. They can live in a cesspool and destroy the planet as we know it, as long as our shores are clean and pure.
Number seven would be the political speech disclosure for federal contractors. In April of 2011, President Obama released a draft executive order, which at the time of the writing of this in December of 2011, that would require businesses with federal contracts to disclose independent expenditures on federal elections, which would be political speech independent of candidates and parties. This order is intended to undermine the Supreme Court's Citizen United decision, allowing independent expenditures by corporations, unions, and other associations by discouraging federal contractors and their executors from engaging in political speech. Citizens United held that such expenditures do not enable the kind of quid pro quo corruption that campaign finance laws are allowed to regulate. So this draft executive order shows contempt for the First Amendment by chilling protected speech.
Yeah. Well, you know, here it is in a nutshell. The president gets to write executive orders based on existing law. He has no authority under the Constitution to write an executive order, number one. But if he's going to write an executive order, then it's in compliance with the clause that says that he will ensure that the laws are faithfully executed. There's no law that requires businesses to disclose independent expenditures. There's no law. None. Zero. So his executive order is a violation of the Constitution. Doesn't matter what the issue is. It's a violation. I've gone back and looked at many of Obama's executive orders. He never cites what law that executive order is based on because it's not based on existing law, and that's a violation of the Constitution.
Number eight being taxing political contributions. Earlier in 2011, the IRS tried to muzzle political speech by asserting that donations to certain nonprofit advocacy groups, so-called 501c4 organizations, would be subject to the gift tax. Historically, the IRS has not applied the gift tax in this way. Donations to advocacy groups are not likely to be used to circumvent the estate tax. And when the IRS previously tried to tax political donations, it was rebuffed by the courts on the grounds that such transfers are not gifts. In other words, the donor is getting something in return. The IRS has since backed down, but the suspicion remains that it was trying to chill the political speech of those opposed to President Obama's policies in violation of the First Amendment.
Yeah, absolutely. And hey, let's take a look at Media Matters. Media Matters, a tax-exempt organization, a nonprofit organization, a politically neutral organization, except they have weekly meetings with Obama's administration to plot and plan and assist the president in his election campaign. That's going to come out in the next few months. It's already come out to a degree, and there's a congressional committee that's looking into that. But Media Matters is going to get fined for its non-apolitical tax-exempt status, and they're going to have to pay back taxes. And it's going to be huge. It's going to be in the tens of millions. So goodbye, Media Matters.
Yep. Number 9, graphic tobacco warnings. Late last year, the FDA issued regulations requiring cigarette manufacturers to display graphic warnings on all packs of cigarettes that must cover at least 50% of the packaging and graphically portray tobacco-related illnesses. These warnings violate the First Amendment because the government is compelling the cigarette manufacturers to discourage their customers from buying their lawful products. The month prior, a federal judge blocked the new regulation, which was due to go into effect in January, but the administration is appealing.
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, the FDA has no legal basis for doing that. In other words, there's no law. Congress did not pass a law, and the Senate did not confirm that, because you know this is something that will cost them money to do this. I mean, not just cost them money in lost product, but they've got to print this on the packaging. That cost them repackaging money. So the Congress, the Senate did not pass this, and the president did not sign it into law. It's not a law. The FDA does not get to write a law. This is a law. This is new legislation. We have got an administration that is governing and legislating by fiat, and it's completely unconstitutional, and it violates the First Amendment because you are telling corporations that you have to say something. Well, they don't want to say it. You know, the First Amendment says we have the right to free speech. Free speech means I get to say what I want, but you can't make me say something that I don't want. In other words, could the government say, Tom, we believe that the church that you attend is racist, so you have to denounce your church. You have to go on TV and denounce your church. Now, I don't, but I mean, that's just if the government decided that. Your church is, whatever, something wrong. We don't like Christianity, which we know that this president has engaged in an assault on not only Christianity and anti-abortion conscience, but think of this. How many people might not really be very religious, but they are anti-abortion, and they refuse to subsidize abortion pills? That's a matter of conscience, and that falls under the First Amendment. So this is an extreme violation of the First Amendment, especially when there has been no legislation, legal legislation passed. The FDA is now engaging in legislation, and that, again, is taxation without representation. Because, Paula, if you and I had stock in a tobacco company, and now they've got to spend money to repackage everything, and it's costing us money, and it's essentially a form of a taxation on us and our future dividends and our investment in that company. So not only does it violate the First Amendment, but it violates the taxation clause, taxation without representation.
Number 10 would be healthcare waivers. The Department of Health and Human Services has granted nearly 2,000 waivers to employers seeking relief from Obamacare's onerous regulations. Nearly 20% of these waivers went to gourmet restaurants and other businesses in Nancy Pelosi's San Francisco district. Nevada, home to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, got a blanket waiver, while Republican-controlled states like Indiana and Louisiana were denied. Even beyond the unseemly political favoritism, such arbitrary dispensations violate a host of constitutional and administrative law provisions, ranging from equal protection to the intelligible principle required for congressional delegation of authority to cabinet agencies. Unlike the 17th century English monarchs, American presidents were not granted dispensing powers. As we've seen, the power to suspend a legal requirement can and will be used to arbitrarily favor the politically connected. Moreover, most of these waivers were never authorized by Congress in the first place. And I just wanted to go on to say that Ilya Shapiro is a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute and editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. And I plan on tweeting this to my Twitter page. It was a very good article, and she had her facts, if it's a woman, she had her facts together when she put this article together.
Absolutely. Well, the president, remember, under the Constitution, has to ensure that the laws are faithfully executed. There's nothing in Obamacare that says that he can grant waivers. So that's a violation of the Constitution right there. He's violating the law. Violating the law, which means he's violating the Constitution. He has no authority to grant waivers. And as you just said, and this article said, is he's able to do it in a way that favors his political allies. So it's political cronyism at its worst and an absolute violation of the Constitution. Well, that was good.
That was a good one. Yep.
That was a very good one. So we're going to go back. I can't take that. Okay, anyways, the Obama
and the other
crybaby.
One with nails.
yeah, oh my gosh. So Obama the crybaby. Let's talk about his speech today in Miami.
Okay.
He said that, it's not his fault that the price of gas is going up. It's not my fault. Well, you know, there's some truth to that. I hate to admit it, but there's some truth to that. But there's so many things that he could have done. Now, he says he's taking measures now to, reduce our dependency on foreign oil. Now, one of those is letting green technologies lead the way. How much did the taxpayer lose on Solyndra and those other companies that all went under? Those companies were absolutely subsidized by you and me. We gave them taxpayer money. But his big lie today was to say that the oil companies are subsidized. He always says that. There's not one oil company in this country that receives a subsidy. A subsidy, Paula, is the government handing you money. We handed Solyndra $500 million. That's right, $500 million. And now they're out of business. Oh, and by the way, some of their top executives are still getting bonuses for the great job they did, and they're out of business. That's a subsidy. That's the failure of this president. That's the incompetence of this president. We're going to lead the way with companies that are incapable of doing anything to reduce our dependency on foreign oil. But drilling at home, increasing our usage of nuclear power, natural gas, et cetera. Now, he says, oh, no, we've expanded all of that. Well, one of the things he said is that oil production or oil refining is up. He said production, but he meant refining. Yes, Paula, oil refining is up. And you know where all of that gasoline is going? Not to us, because U.S. gasoline usage is down. We're shipping it overseas. And do you know why? Because oil companies, and we always call them oil companies, most of these companies don't actually drill oil for oil. They refine oil. Now, they refine much of their own oil, but we have 60% of our oil is imported. That's what they're refining, imports. They're refining it. But then they're shipping it overseas because they can make more money. One of the reasons they can make more money is because they can refine it any way they want and ship it overseas. It doesn't matter. We have something like 40-some different blends that have to be blended based on the state, the time of year, on and on and on, based on the EPA and its regulations or state regulations. So that costs the quote oil companies, money. They can refine it one way and ship it overseas and make money, and the
the money they make overseas is better. Now, this goes to our economy. Why is the Dow up so high? Why does it appear that the economy is doing well? It's because many of these companies, which are global companies, are making money overseas. They're not making money here. Their stock is up because they're making money overseas. Now, aside from the oil companies, a lot of these companies make money overseas because they have to hire overseas. Many foreign nations require that if you want to do business here, you have to establish your company here and hire people here to do this particular job. It's not all just manufacturing. So the vast majority of jobs that are being created with this so-called booming economy, if you look at the stock market, are being created overseas, not here. That's why the what was that latest poll? The Gallup poll says that unemployment is going to go back up to 9% for February. When the numbers come out in March, unemployment is going to go back up. So even though the Dow is doing well, the stock market is doing well, it's because our companies have grown more and more international and are making money overseas. So, yeah, they're making money. If you own stock and you're invested in a lot of these companies, good for you, and I'm all for that. But it's because they're making money overseas, not at home. So the home economy is hurting, but they're doing well overseas, and they're hiring and expanding overseas. So when he says that fuel production is up, yes, so that we can ship it away. And when he says that demand is down because the economy's down. The economy's crappy. So he's taking credit for a crappy economy. It's like saying, and they do, they're saying that illegal immigration is at an all-time low. Why is it at an all-time low? Because we have a crappy economy and nobody wants to come here. So good. Good for you, President. Take credit for a crappy economy. Hey, everybody, you can thank me for a crappy economy. Wow, that's a campaign statement right there. So we've got all these requirements on the different blends. But the other thing is, he says, now this is the insight into a Marxist. The ideology of a Marxist is that, Paula, your money, my money, the corporations, big and small out there, small businesses, mom and pop businesses, all of the money they earn is not really theirs. It's the government's. Whatever they get to keep is a subsidy. So when he says that the oil companies are being subsidized by taxpayers, which is what he said, what he's really saying is there aren't subsidies, there are tax breaks. There's a huge difference. Subsidy, the government gives you money, Paula. A tax break means you get to keep more of your money. But he just can't get away from the concept that your money is yours, and the more you keep, well, it's yours. In his mind, the more money that you keep, the more you're taking away from government. So now he says it's not fair. So if you want to go along with his logic and assume that oil companies' tax breaks are actually subsidies, in other words, their money is not theirs, whatever they get to keep, the government's giving them, that would mean that it's not the taxpayers that are paying the price. It's government is paying the price, and government needs more of their money. So when he says he's going to raise taxes on corporations and the evil oil companies, who's going to subsidize those increased taxes? You and I, Paula, the middle class will subsidize it because we will pay higher prices. This is how the president, this is how a Marxist gets money from the masses, leads the masses to believe that the profitable corporations are too profitable and therefore must be stopped. But where does that money go? If the government raises taxes on oil companies or takes away their deductions, who pays for it? Not the companies. Over the last 50 years, Paula, corporate taxes have gone up, they've gone down. Capital gains have gone up, they've gone down. Dividend payouts have gone up, or dividend taxes have gone up, they've gone down. But the oil companies, large and small, their profit margins have remained the same. So when taxes go up, yet they still have the same profit margin, who's paying those taxes? The consumer. This is how the Marxist gets money out of the masses. So the beauty of this is, a year, 2 years on down the road, the president can say, oh, we've reeled in billions of dollars from the oil companies by ending their tax breaks and putting fees on them and such, you know, everything else. But guess what? They're still making more money than ever before. Well, then we've got to raise taxes even further. You know what that means? You and I will pay even more for gasoline. Corporations never, ever, ever pay taxes. The consumer pays the taxes. So it's an outright lie to say that they're being subsidized. But here's one of the things that he said, and I'm going to read it from his speech today. He said, right now, $4 billion of your tax dollars subsidize the oil industry every year. No, our tax dollars don't subsidize anything. Those companies in the oil industry save $4 billion of their own money, which reduces our cost at the pump. These are the same oil companies that have been making record profits. Well, first of all, Paul, they're making record profits because they raise their prices to maintain an 8 to 10% profit margin. So you and I are paying not 8 to 10% higher, we're paying much more than it because it's 8 to 10% on the price. So as the price continues to go up, they're going to still maintain their profit margin because they have shareholders that they have to account for. And their shareholders want to get 8 to 10%. And that's what they're going to get every year, year after year, and they've always gotten that. He continues, it's outrageous, it's inexcusable. This is an outright lie. It's not outrageous. It's not inexcusable. Google's profit margin is 30%. Apple's profit margin is 25%. Why is he not going after them and adding taxes on every iPod and iPhone and usage of the internet? Because they're easy targets. When we have to pay $4 a gallon at the pump, we get mad at the oil companies. But the majority of that cost is state and federal taxes. That's where the majority of the cost is. If you eliminated all federal and state taxes on gasoline, it'd be down at something like $2 a gallon. Now, he continues, every politician who's been fighting to keep these subsidies in place should explain to the American people why the oil industry needs more of their money. Well, here's why. They don't need more of our money, but his failed policies are giving them more of our money. That's the exact profile of a Marxist, telling Americans, telling any people, that these big bad corporations are taking more of your money, and why do they need more of it? Well, first of all, when they do get more of our money, it goes into investment, it goes into investors. There are plenty of pension funds, plenty of government and private pension funds that rely on oil company profits. So if we take away their profits, goodbye pension. I mean, I did a show last night, Paula, where we talked precisely on who does this hurt the most. It hurts the middle class and especially hurts pensioners and those that are about to be relying on a pension. So he continues, a century of subsidies to the oil companies is long enough. Again, it's an outright lie. There have never been subsidies to the oil companies. There have only been tax breaks. And most of those tax breaks, Paula, go to the smaller companies, the very, very small companies, that without those tax breaks, it would be impossible for them to go and drill in new locations and to do the exploration and then to actually turn a profit, because they invest a tremendous amount of money in equipment, and equipment that must constantly be replaced. This Congress, okay, so here we go. This Congress needs to renew the clean energy tax credits that will lead to more jobs and less dependence on foreign oil. Let me back up. A century of subsidies to oil companies long enough. It's time in taxpayer giveaways. In other words, we're giving them their own money. It's their money to begin with. But again, the Marxist view. To an industry that's never been more profitable and double down on clean energy industry. Oh, yeah, let's double down, Paula, on Solyndra. Let's double down on it. Yep, let's double down on failed businesses that can't compete on their own and have to have subsidies, actual true subsidies. So it's an outright lie when he says that they're getting subsidies and that we, the taxpayer, are funding it. But when their taxes go up, they'll roll that into the bottom line, and who's going to fund, and where does that money go? Paula, do you and I get that money when more taxes come from the oil companies? No, it doesn't go to you and me. It goes
no.
to the government. This is about growing government at my and your expense, our expense. This is a plot. It's not a plot. It's just a standard government plan to get more money from the middle class without raising their taxes. It's precisely how it works. So I think I've beat that one to death. But that's precisely what it is. And the real subsidies, the only real subsidies that are going to any energy companies are the green companies, and the vast majority of those have failed. I'm all for green companies and green technologies, but it goes back to my explanation of technology. When it's ready, it's ready. Anybody with a great idea can make money. Anybody. Anybody with a great idea can make money. But when the cavemen were sitting around in their caves and lamenting about how dangerous it is to go hunting with their spears, big game, and they need to feed their families, it's very dangerous, spears aren't real accurate, doesn't always kill the beast, and you know, some of us end up getting eaten or killed in the fight, and on and on. We need to come up with a way to kill the big game much more effectively and efficiently. And one of the cavemen said, you know what, I've got a great idea. I'll tell you what I'm going to call this in a moment, but we need something that you can hold in your hand that will launch a projectile at a very high rate of velocity with high impact, that very accurate, and you can do from a distance, so you don't even have to get close to the game. I'm going to call it a gun. And guess what? 15,000, I'll say that again, 15,000 years later. Let me back up, though. In line with what this Marxist wants to do, somebody said, well, I've got a great idea how we can invent your gun, Tom. Let's take half of our spears and break them in half so that we only have half as many spears. And of course, this is cap and trade. We only have half as many spears, which makes it much more dangerous and will force us and push us to invent your gun. 15,000 years later, the gun is finally invented. You cannot force technology. You can make things as dangerous, as untenable, and as unhappy as you want. And it was his own Secretary of Energy who said, we have got to get the price of gasoline up to that close to Europe so that people can feel the pain, so that they'll start commuting and not driving and get in really, really tiny, dangerous cars. Now, he didn't say all of that, but that's what he basically said is, we need to get the price of gasoline up to that level that you see in Europe. We've got to cause pain. And the president himself said, we're going to feel a lot of pain when it comes to the cost of energy. That's what we need. So there's no surprise that the price of gas is going up, but he says, oh, it's not my fault. It is absolutely his fault. Normally, it wouldn't be the fault of a president, but in this case, it absolutely is, because he's done everything to undermine our energy industry here in the United States of America. So he's a crybaby. It's not my fault. You know, remember, self-serving bias is something where people take take credit for their achievements, but blame somebody else for their failures. I've never seen anybody in my life blame other people for their failures like this guy. I mean, I've never seen him once say, yeah, my fault, bad on me. He can't do it because, honestly, he doesn't think he's done anything wrong. Marxism is his religion, is his theology. He believes in it more than anything else, and he will do whatever it takes to achieve it. Give me four more years. Essentially what he's saying is, I've failed, the price of gasoline is up, but give me four more years and I'll make things right. Sorry, as Donald Trump would say, you're fired. So anyway, that's the problem with this guy. He really believes in Marxism more than anything else. And your money is not your money, it's the government's. Mm-hmm. And the government subsidizes you and me, Paula. All the money that we have that's ours after taxes, that's a subsidy. Because that's what he's saying about the oil companies. It's a subsidy. Any of the money you have left over after taxes, that's a subsidy. But the problem is, the only way for that to be true is not that the taxpayers are subsidizing it, the government is subsidizing it, because it all belongs to the government to begin with, which means go after the rich, go after the corporations, the taxpayers will foot the bill, because they are not just taxpayers, they're consumers, and that's how you raise taxes on the middle class without actually raising taxes on the middle class. All right. We've covered that a lot, and had a very good show last night talking about this very subject, about corporations and his plan to lower corporate taxes, but his raising of the dividend tax, I mean tripling down on the dividend tax, will squash that and remove any desire for corporations, and I gave you the proof last night of the corporations that that's happened to in the past, to actually give dividends. So it's going to hurt pensioners, and we, the consumer, are going to pay it in the end anyway, because they're still going to get their cut. It's just like grocery stores. If he were to go after grocery stores, their profit margin is only like 1% to 2%. If you raise the taxes on grocery stores, they can't eat that tax. They can't just pay it out of their profits, because it isn't there. It doesn't exist. A 10% increase on the tax of oil companies wipes out all of their profits. So are they just going to not have any profits from here on out forever? No. They're just going to raise the price of their product, not 10%, but 15%, because they have to give a 10% return to their investors. It's not about giving an amount of money to their investors. It's about a percentage. So you and I, a 10% tax on the oil companies will result in a 15% increase in our cost of gasoline. So we've got the president lying about subsidies, deceiving about the nature of corporate profits, and lying about gasoline production and usage in this country. So anyway, what are your thoughts, Paula? I've gone on for a long time now.
Oh, don't worry about it. I mean, I feel the same way. There's always discussion about this, and you know, there are some people that think it's okay to implement the taxes, you know, just so we could get out of debt. And I feel that the majority doesn't feel that that's right. And it seems to be snowballing as time goes on. And, you know, because the way the economy is, people really are cutting back on certain things. And whether it's buying cigarettes or determining, you know, whether they want to top off the tank at the gas station, or, you know, they need the car to go from point A to point B, so they're going to cut back on the other, if you want to call them luxuries, whether it's going out to the movies or going out to dinner or, you know, buying clothes or going on vacation. They know that, you know, the taxes that are implemented, for good or for bad, they're still there. And it seems that as time goes on, it's just going to continue to snowball. And
yeah.
I'm not sure if we're hearing anything from, you know, on the GOP side, on the debates. You know, I came across an article that was published in Reuters that, you know, each Republican candidate says he cares about the deficit, and each candidate's plan, I mean, I'm not putting down the GOP by any means, but I mean, each candidate's plan raises the deficit. Are they all bad at math, or do they just not care enough to do it right? You know, it's I think it's one thing to rob Peter to pay Paul, you know, so to speak, if I'm using the correct analogy, but, you know, in this state, there are certain programs that are getting, you know, shut down, if I'm using the right term. They're getting cut so that other programs can survive. But I don't feel that the right programs are getting cut so that, you know, things can thrive in the states.
Well, you're right about that. And here's the deal. His plan is to go after corporations, but that all that does is go after the consumer. So the way to get out of debt, or the way to grow government and then just sustain ourselves at a regular rate of debt, is just to take more money from the people. If we were to shut down every corporation that's doing business overseas and say, you can't, you know, you're going to pay a penalty, you got to do it here in the States, you will see stock market crash. You will see our economy crash. You will see the dollar become worthless. The price of gold in the U.S. compared to, you know, on the dollar standard will go to, you know, $10,000 per ounce of gold. He will crash the economy. But he's not going to do that until after the election. He can't afford to do it, but that's what he wants to do. He wants to raise taxes, and I guarantee you this, he has not said anything about not raising taxes on middle class after the election. He said that this bill, that bill, this plan, that plan won't affect anybody making less than $250,000. But I guarantee you after he gets reelected, if that were to happen, and it's not going to happen, thank goodness, but all of a sudden he'll go, you know what? This stuff was all good, and I told you we got to go after the rich and we got to go after the big bad companies, but it's not enough. So we're all going to have to dig down and just, you know, pay the price, and we got to raise taxes on everything.
Right.
Except,
today,
yeah.
Today
except
the
poor, yeah. Or the people on entitlements, no, they won't get anything. But the middle class, people actually making money and productive that aren't getting any entitlements, the 50%. We're going to have to take a lot more of your money because, really, you know, it's just the right thing to do.
Exactly. And the public debt is equal to about 70% of our economy. So if the Congress allows current law to play itself out and the Bush tax cuts would expire, that number should fall to about 60%. And, you know, they think that's pretty stable, but nobody wants the current law scenario to play out. Not Congress, not the Senate, not the White House, and it looks like certainly not the Republican field. So, you know, there's talk that we would need another plan, but most other plans don't get anywhere near stability. The GOP plans would raise our debt burden to anywhere between 67 and 126% of the economy by 2021.
Yeah, I mean, first of all of his plans so far said we're going to cut this and cut that over the next 10 years. But we're going to print this much money, we're going to spend this much money right now. In other words, we're going to spend an extra $1 trillion we don't have now, but we'll cut $1 trillion over the next 10 years. I mean, just do the math. If you did that every single year, it's like taking a credit card and saying, over the next 10 years, I'm going to pay down, let's say you've got a $10,000 credit card bill. Over the next 10 years, I'm going to pay down $1,000. But this year, I'm going to put an extra $1,000 on the credit card. Well, where are you going to be 10 years from now? You're going to be $20,000 in the hole, minus the $1,000 you've paid down. Okay, so you only owe $19,000. There's no end to this. Everything he proposes is over 10 years to cut, but spend now, spend next year, spend the next year, which puts us, honestly, by 2020 at something like $25 trillion in debt. So all of his so-called cuts really don't cut anything. And I'll go back to something that I say all the time on this show. The size of the federal government, that is the executive branch and all of its agencies and discretionary spending and non-mandatory spending, equals each year in the budget so far $1.3 trillion. All of Medicare and Social Security spending, which the money isn't there, it's being used to fund the government. So we're getting IOUs from the Treasury, equals $1.3 trillion. The military budget for last year was $6.7 billion, so less than a trillion, almost half of the federal government, almost half of Social Security and Medicare. I'm going to leave Social Security and Medicare away. This president has gone aggressively after the military, cutting not only military funding but military jobs. In other words, putting our troops on the streets. He's not made one proposal to cut the size of the federal government. He cares more about the federal government than he does about our troops, our national security, and actually reducing any kind of debt whatsoever. And, you know, he's made it very clear in the past that government jobs are more important than any other job that there is. In fact, let's play that little
song. Workers like you for the federal, state, and local governments are so important for our vital services. And it frustrates me sometimes when people talk about government jobs as if somehow those are worth less than private sector jobs. I think there's nothing more important than working on behalf of the American people.
Yeah, not working on behalf of the American people, working on the American people's dime, getting funded by the American people, and that's why he's made not one proposal that cuts the size of the federal government. He's willing to cut the military, and he's more than happy to cut entitlements because Obamacare cuts $500 billion over 10 years out of Medicare. Now, remember the Democrats running those ads that the Republicans want to throw Granny under the bus. Well, Obama already threw Granny under the bus. He already did it. It's done. It's a done deal. Medicare is thrown under the bus. He, in his second term, he's not talking about it now because it's unpopular, but once he doesn't have to worry about getting reelected, you watch him aggressively go after Medicare and probably Social Security as well and throw every senior under the bus. I mean, literally under the bus. But government, oh, no, that's not only going to stay at $1.3 trillion. I'll bet you in future years he's going to propose pumping up the federal government to $2 billion a year. He just cannot, because that's the Marxist in him. The federal government is more important than anything else. All right. Well, Paula, thanks for a great show. I'll let you take us out.
You're welcome. I want to give a special shout-out to a young man who is down in Parris Island, South Carolina, a very dear friend of mine. Joel and Greg Mendes, their son, Zach, is in Marine Fox Company, 2nd Recruit Battalion, Platoon 2036. He's in training right now. He dropped this in his parents' lap a couple of weeks ago and decided that he was going to join, and that's where he is right now. He's the brother of Jesse Mendes, and I'm sure soon, sometime soon after their what they're doing there, they will be deployed overseas. We're going to do something quick honoring the fallen, where the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have claimed the lives of more than 450 Americans this year. Five names I'm going to read: Derek Carlisle Benson, 28, Nicholas Paul Wilford Bernier, 21, Nathan Ryan Byers, 24, Rafael Enrique Big Eye Baez, 28, and Brian Robert Bill, 31. From the militarytimes.com, Navy Special Warfare Operator Petty Officer First Class Seal Derek C. Banson lost his life on August 6, 2011, serving during Operation Enduring Freedom. He was 28 years old, of Anguin, California, and he was assigned to an East Coast-based SEAL team. He perished August 6, 2011, in Wardak Province, Afghanistan, of wounds suffered when the CH-47 Chinook helicopter in which he was riding was shot down. Special Warfare Operator First Class SEAL Derek Banson. He attended basic underwater demolition SEAL training at Coronado, California, and later checked into Navy Special Warfare Advanced Training Command at Coronado. He joined a West Coast-based SEAL team in June 2003 and then moved to an East Coast-based SEAL team in September 2009. His decorations include Bronze Star Medal with V Device for Valor, two Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medals, one with V Device for Valor, Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medal, Combat Action Ribbon, Presidential Unit Citation, Good Conduct Medal, National Defense Medal, Global War on Terrorism Service Medal, Afghanistan Campaign Medal, and a Rifleman Marksmanship Medal and a Pistol Marksmanship Medal. The young man was well decorated. You know, thoughts and prayers go out to his family, to the Mendes family. We are going to keep Zach and his platoon in our prayers when they do eventually get deployed, and that they do get to come home as time moves on. To the rest that are serving overseas, your families love and miss you dearly. We keep you in our prayers every night, and we want you home as soon as, you know, it's allowed.
Well, thank you. And you know what? I don't hold a candle to any of those incredible war heroes, and I appreciate them so much. And I told you you'd take it out, but I want to say thanks to the seven brave Marines that lost their lives in a training exercise today in Yuma, Arizona.
Definitely.
I've spent hundreds of hours in that very training area, flying a variety of different fighters over the years, and I know it well. And our hearts go out to all of them, and we thank them, because just because you sacrifice in training or in peacetime doesn't mean that you're not a war hero. Those gentlemen, and there might have even been some women involved in that, I don't know. They are true heroes and war heroes, and everything that our troops do, whether it be in training, in peace, at home or abroad, is absolutely necessary to our national defense. And it's a tragic incident that occurred. Those things happen, and we all know the risks. But at the same time, they gave their lives for their country. That was not in vain. They gave their lives for this country. We will learn from that incident so that it doesn't happen on the battlefield, and that's why we train. That's why we always say you train, you fight like you train. You got to train hard so that you can fight hard. And those gentlemen that you read off their names, they fought hard, and they gave the ultimate sacrifice, and their families have given the ultimate sacrifice. And we owe them a debt of gratitude that can never, ever be repaid. God bless them all. And thank you, Paula, for doing that at the end of every show. It's important to remember them and immortalize them, because they deserve it.
They do, and they should not be forgotten. And another thing, I mean, I personally think that we as citizens of this country, that, you know, as we see the troops walking around, say in the malls or in restaurants, go up to them and shake their hands and tell them thank you very much for what you do, whether or not they're here, you know, doing their time, or they're overseas and they're home visiting, go up to them and shake their hands and tell them thank you very much.
Well, I'll tell you this, and I probably shouldn't be saying this on the radio, but whenever I have military on the airplane and there are empty first-class seats, I move them up. And we're supposed to do that as a matter of policy. The agents are supposed to do that. But it doesn't always happen. And I did that just the other day. And one of the reasons I do it is when I have a military man or woman in uniform sitting in business class, I want them as close to the cockpit door as possible. They know how to handle themselves, and I consider it a matter of airplane security. So I always upgrade all military traveling in uniform up to business class if there are seats. And honestly, there aren't very often seats, but they deserve it. They absolutely deserve it, and I don't even hesitate.
Of course they do.
In fact, the other day I had a family. A gentleman in the Army who is traveling with his wife and three young children. And I brought them all up to business class, mainly because he deserves it. But also my excuse, the way I get away with it, is that, number one, I'm the captain. But two, I want that military man or woman as close to the cockpit as possible, because it's good for the security of the entire airplane. But that aside, they deserve it. I wish I didn't have to make that excuse, but that's my excuse so that I can get away with it for, because it's my airplane. I get to decide on security issues, and that's my call. But, I tell you, I just appreciate them so much. I got to see a midshipman the other day traveling on the airplane. I think it was my airplane. I don't know. I saw him out there in the terminal. I went over and sat down with him and told him, you got a great career ahead of you. I had a blast. The academy is not always the funnest place to be. Some people had a lot of fun. I didn't. But when you get out there and actually get to participate in the military and have a career, it's an awesome thing. So it's a somber moment when we lose our fellow soldiers. At the same time, this, unlike Obama saying that government job is the most important, this is a extremely important job, to serve in the military, and the people that do serve in the military want to be there, and that's the key. They want to be there. They're not forced to be there. They want to be there, and that's why they are so exceptional and do such a good job. So, all right. I got a little verbose on that. But anyways, thank you, Paula. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We'll be back next week with our Obumbler watch. Yeah, I know it's not right to be saying that about the President of the United States, but he is. He's incompetent. But we'll be back next week with our Obumbler watch and his new set of non-truths, I'll put it that way, and deceptions and incompetence and unconstitutional. It's becoming almost a daily event now, his unconstitutional acts. So that was a great article that you brought up, Paula. But anyways, have a great rest of the week, great weekend, and we'll see you next week.
You as well. Thank you. Bye.
You're listening to The American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.